Mind Frames, the sometimes half-assed but, as you know, always wholehearted film conversation. With you, as always, it's me, Michael Cockrell, and on the other side of the computer screen is my good friend,
Dave Canfield.
And here we are. Can you believe 2022? It's come and gone. What a year for film. Did you see any movies this year, Dave?
I saw a few movies this year. In fact, this was a record year for me for the last 3 years.
You know, in 2020 and 2021, you heard me say I didn't see enough movies. I think 2022, I did okay. I had some notable misses, but I think I saw all of the heavy hitters and a few that I just wanted to see for fun. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about five films, the joint Mind Frames recommendations for 2022. Are these the best films of the year? No. Well, they might be, but they're not necessarily in a sequential order of greatness. These are films that me and Dave sat down together and agreed really are things that you can't miss. They reflect something in the air, something in the air tonight of 2022 that you do not want to miss. So there are a couple themes that run through these movies, Dave. Islands, identities in flux, estrangement.
Yes. It was amazing how much thematic unity we saw and that we saw between movies that you would never put together as, like, say, a double feature even. But I would say really all the movies that we're going to talk about fit into all those categories that you just talked about.
So let's waste no further time. Let's get right into it and talk about, I would call this our outlier, Dave. This first movie, it comes to us from the subcontinent. It comes to us from India. It's RRR. We all know RRR. We love it. That is the South Indian film directed by S.S. Rajamouli. I couldn't think of his first name, but I'm just going to go with S.S., I guess. So starring, you know, it's starring some of the top South African actors and South Indian. Sorry, not African. South Indian actors. Yeah, I don't think there's any South Africans in here. I'd have to think about that. But some of the most famous South Indian actors. I forget the language that it's in. I knew it when we saw it, but me and Dave had the chance to see this movie with the director in a unique way, with the director at the Music Box. I'm sure many of you in Chicago were there, and it definitely engendered it to our hearts because it was a very lively audience. Do you remember that night, Dave?
Well, you know, you get to go to the movies and have a collective experience every once in a while. And what I mean by that is, when a movie really has a great impact on the whole audience, and it's shared as that great experience, and you know, the Music Box's main room seats 700 people. I looked that up, and it was full. I mean, there may have been empty seats. I didn't see any or notice any. I know we were completely surrounded. And, you know, it was kind of interesting because I recall seeing some people of Indian descent there, but mostly it was just people that I think were film fans. And this movie had been getting a lot of buzz online. There had been a trailer that had gone, I think, viral by this point. And all of a sudden, I found myself, as we're watching this movie, being carried by the energy of the rest of that crowd. And they had their moments when they booed the villain collectively, when they cheered the heroes, when they clapped along with the dance sequences and the music in the film. Huge raucous laughter and reactions to all the action set pieces. It was probably, without hyperbole, it's probably the most fun I've ever had in a movie screening in my life. It's one of those things I'll probably never get again. It just was a perfect blend of audience and movie and film craft. It was just amazing.
I think it's one that you all should see. And what makes this movie great? We're going to talk about why is this a great movie? What did it do to deserve to be in our top five? For me, even if you don't have the chance to see it with a live action-packed audience, it is an action-packed movie in its own right. You don't need the audience there pushing you on. This film has out-of-control energy. It's goofy enough to keep you interested. In a way, it's the ultimate Indian movie, and all of the tropes that you think of when you think of an Indian movie, it has all of those to the ninth degree. Yes. And I think that's really its total embrace of that is what makes it truly unique and truly something you should see.
I mean, the bad guys in it are the colonial Brits, and the good guys are an undercover cop who has made friends with somebody and doesn't realize that person is somebody that he's supposed to be arresting because he's trying to be a seditious influence against the British. And so it's, you know, got that kind of like energy where all the characters are discovering things about each other constantly against this backdrop, like you said, of out of controlness. And I could definitely watch it over and over and over again. It's the kind of movie, I think it came out in a really big deluxe box set, I would buy the nicest version of it I could.
So I know that these actors and this director have been wanting to work together for a long time. They are all superstars in the south of India. So them coming together was a big deal. And even though, one of the actors plays a bad guy, I think Ram plays a bad guy, right? Yeah. He is so beloved. He's a complicated character. But when you see he's introduced as a villain, but he's so beloved that the audience cheers when he's introduced. And if you were there that night, it was a truly unique cultural experience. I've been to like Bollywood movies before with a very lively audience, but have I been to one that lively? Probably not. And that's definitely because it's a community within a community. It's not just an Indian movie, but it's an Indian movie from a very particular part of India. They feel a lot of group solidarity. They're trying to explain it to me. Like they're from two states and the states haven't always gotten along. I think like Uttar Pradesh or some states that speak this language. And so it's like there's a lot of things going on there that like we as Westerners or even people from other parts of India might not pick up on. But at the same time, the creators went out of their way to give it a Indian-wide, overtly Indian-wide independence nationalistic message, but also a human message in there. It totally embraces what it is. Thematically fitting into 2022.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, what do you think?
This is a rough one. You know, this is, like I said, this is an outlier. One of the themes of 2022 that we saw over and over again that I do think this fits into, and it being from India does make it difficult to fit into the rest of the movies, which are Western movies. But there is a theme that I think is so broad and so global for this moment, and that is the powerful being punished. And the British as the bad guy is pretty common in Indian films, right? I mean, Lagan, you could go on and on mentioning, you know, where there are cartoon British films, which is the case here. The bad guys here are cartoons. But at the same time, there is something incredibly 2022 about the way in which they are punished that I think goes beyond India and spills out into like a global theme. We see that in a couple of the other movies we're going to talk about today. We saw that in, I don't want to spoil what our other movies are going to be, but we'll get to that more. What our other movies, but I think you can, if you think about movies that came out in 2022, you can think of a lot of movies where the guilty are being punished.
Well, and here, I think that's an interesting thing because when we think of Bollywood, you know, we have that idea of happy people dancing, singing, boisterousness, very colorful, you know, things going on. And this is a movie that revels in that. And that's almost what you feel like defeats the British in this movie is that's the spirit that the British can't break. And that does set RRR apart, I think, from a lot of the other movies where we get a grimmer picture of this idea of the guilty being punished. But here it's just, it's just like a dancing in the streets type experience. It's really, really wonderful and hopeful.
Right. Sorry to be umming so much, but considering whether to go further on that line. Another common theme of 2022, and this has been beyond 2022, this has been going on for years, and that is the meta-ness. RRR is very meta. It is on the nose, unapologetically, an Indian movie, and I think it's self-aware of that. It's not just that the director, I don't think it's just that the director lost restraint. I think it's that the movie is intentionally made to be over the top.
Yeah.
But I don't think I know enough about this director.
Well, this guy's made a movie that was done from the point of view of a fly called Ega, which is also on Netflix and is really fun. And he's known for kind of having these over the top, you know, things going on in his films. But I think that meta-ness that you're talking about, one of the great things about this movie is, you know, we all have friends, right? And you try to tell your friends, hey, you should go see this. And you get these things. Is it subtitled? Is it in black and white? You know, that's always a bummer, you know, when you love something and somebody won't engage with it for reasons like that. This is a movie anybody can watch and enjoy and really, really have fun with. And I think it's such a cool breakthrough thing. You know, I'm really hoping that we see more Indian cinema finally really becoming available in meaningful ways here stateside. I know there's a lot of people working really hard on it, like Josh Hurtado with Screen Anarchy and different people who've just, you know, put their heart and soul into trying to promote the form and support it. But, you know, India is really going through hard times right now with their film culture too. There's a lot of censorship in India, and, particularly anything that's seen as anti-government can really, get filmmakers in different kinds of hot water and have different aspects of their films taken out of their hands and whatnot. And right now, India is potentially losing a large portion of its archive of films because the agency that deals with it has been more or less disbanded by the Indian government. So if I'm to understand that, that thing, you know, you can imagine if, you know, suddenly, I mean, you know, like all the master, the, like, you know, your national heritage just disappeared. Hopefully that's not going to happen. And the success of RRR will infuse more interest in supporting Indian cinema.
Our next pick is, you know, it's not, you know, Dave, it's not one of my favorite movies of the year. I absolutely love it. It is in my top 10. But I think one reason I wanted to discuss it, and I think you felt the same way, was because I don't think it got its due. And it's ironic because it's a blockbuster. It's The Batman.
Yeah.
This is a movie I just feel like it just got a little overlooked, Dave. So we are talking about The Batman. I feel like it's the best superhero movie of the year. I think it's... you know, we saw a couple, didn't we? We saw Thor: Love and Thunder. We saw Doctor Strange goes into the multiple universes, whatever. We didn't see the Spider-Man one though, did we?
We did.
Nevertheless,
the Spider-Man one was very well reviewed.
I'm not really into Spider-Man. I guess that was an oversight on my part. But I love the street level Batman. I love that this Batman felt real. He was on the street fighting villains that look like the bad guys we see on TV, fighting crime with his fists, not flying up in the sky in the bat jet.
Kind of a proud boy element in the film.
Yeah. I like that. I felt a connection with this movie, and especially the ending, which I know we're going to talk about. But to me, it's like getting Batman back down to the ground, fighting him, having him living in this world. I thought emo Batman was great with the eyeliner. You know, I love Robert Pattinson. You know, I think he's Robert a great Pattinson actor.
He's done so many good, really great things. You know, Good Times and The Lighthouse, and you know, we did an episode on High Rise, the film he made with the great French director. I can't remember her name off the top of my head.
It's High Life.
Yeah, High Life. Thank you.
Not High Rise. Claire Denis is Claire Denis. We mentioned that in our last episode.
You know, the funny
thing. Very weird movie.
The funny thing about this movie is it really reinvigorates the franchise. I mean, we've been making Batman movies for a long time, and this movie came out, I think, when there was a little like bat fatigue. And people are just like, you know, can we kind of move on and do some other things? Which I think is kind of funny. I was hearing that, and I'm just thinking, man, there's all sorts of superhero movies. And Batman Year One, the interesting thing about that book, and that's what this borrows heavily from, this film, is it's very, again, kind of noirish, kind of more realistic Batman in the real world, as opposed to Batman, you know, just like a cartoon, or being able to sort of bat shark repellent his way out of whatever comes his way. And, you know, something about this movie is everything in it feels real. You know, Paul Dano plays the Riddler, and he's a fearsome villain. And this is a dark film. This is not a film that sanitizes the shadows of its sort of noir aesthetic. It leans into them, and in every way, shape, or form, you know, Matt Reeves, I think, did with this what he does with everything he touches, which is to make it better. And you know, this is definitely a movie that, you know, you're going to see a sequel to, and it'll be really interesting to see what comes of that, what they're gonna tackle. They tease the Joker at the end of it.
Yes.
And I have to admit, I would really love to see that, but I don't know. Is there another villain you'd like to see, Mike?
No, I would love to see the Joker. Yeah, I hope a sequel comes out of this.
And they're talking about it. I mean, I think it's a done deal at this point. The only wild card was Pattinson, because he had a really hard time in the making of this.
I think the reason this movie was underlooked is I think there is a little bit of superhero fatigue. There's going into the Nolan shoes. That's pretty hard. Those films are so beloved. But please check it out. And how does this fit into the 2022 zeitgeist? You know, coming out of COVID, in this world of social media, a lot of the themes that we're seeing in film are about estrangement, being apart, being separated from others. In fact, so many of the movies are going so far as to have their setting or an aspect of their setting or plot be an island. Not this movie. There is an island in this movie, the pseudo Manhattan, but we won't take it that far and say that this is an island movie. But it is a movie about estrangement. This is a loner Batman. A Batman who's even like struggling with Andy Serkis's very interesting portrayal of Alfred. Batman that is estranged. But unlike in a couple of other movies this year that we're going to talk about, this film takes on that estrangement, that lack of connection head on. And it shows Gotham not struggling from the fatigue of COVID, but struggling from crime, people not trusting each other. And Batman standing up as a beacon of hope. Batman has to overcome his distrust and work with Catwoman, played by Zoe Kravitz, in The Batman. But what I really love is at the end of the movie is that the solution to the problem is the solution to Gotham's problems is not Batman beating up the hero. It's the city coming together. And I think we all feel disconnected. We're all standing on that train, just like you know, the character was in Batman, waiting for some hero to come along and scare away the bad guys. But at the end of the day, we all have to come together, work together, and rebuild our society. And I think that that message at the end of Batman, which is so kind of anti-hero, right? That's the opposite of a hero. Right. We're all the hero. You're like, you're the real hero, as a Homelander might say. We need to come together and build our society back together. And I think this is one of the few films in 2022 that addressed that estrangement, but yeah, also offered a solution to it. Other films we're going to talk about, they just kind of, I'm not saying that you have to, but just bringing it up is great. But it's weird that the Batman offered a solution to that.
Yeah, this brings him, and Batman's more of a detective in this film too, which I think has always been a very interesting aspect of the character. If you go back to the Detective Comics of the 1970s, which was a reboot of the character and an attempt to sort of get him out of the cartoony sort of wave of titles he'd been trapped in. But here, you know, Paul Dano, as I said, plays the Riddler. And the Riddler is a villain. The Riddler is, but the Riddler is definitely, I don't know what the word is, but there's more going on with the Riddler than just him being just an evil being. Here, I think you get a very wounded person, and a person that has chosen the wrong route to address their wounds. And, you know, there's a reason in the Batman world they have Arkham Asylum. And you really get a sense of the Dano character belonging in an Arkham Asylum rather than in just a jail cell. It deals with him and the issues that he raises about Gotham and the corruption in Gotham in a pretty adult way and in a complex way that would have been easy to just, you know, write off. And you know, Matt Reeves doesn't do that. I think that's one of the great things about this movie.
The next film is a more conventional pick. It's one of the movies everyone's talking about. I think it's in both of our top threes, Dave. Not that we numbered them, but it is The Banshees of Inisherin. We're getting more directly into that island estrangement theme here. But what makes this movie great, I think, is there's not really a boring moment. But at the same time, there's kind of not really an exciting moment either. But it has this great balance of humor and darkness, of lighthearted country fare, bucolic scenes, but also an underlining, disturbing darkness to it.
Yeah.
Like, specifically, you know, we have scenes of mutilation, but they're almost like prop comedy. Like, the fingers that Brendan Gleeson's character is chopping off are like props in a comedy act.
Treated like props, yeah.
So it's. I think it has a very, very peculiar balance that keeps it interesting. You know.
Well, an interesting thing about this movie, and we talk about it being on an island, and we talk about estrangement, is you do get to meet various people on the island, and they're all, to a person, fairly awful. There's an abusive police officer. There's his son, played by Barry Keoghan, in a stunning performance, who kind of plays the village idiot and is always hanging around Colin Farrell's character. You have the smart, single woman sort of on the verge of becoming a spinster, which is a character I see in these kinds of movies a lot, I think. And you see, you know, the nosy, gossipy old biddy in the town. But these characters aren't played as if they're harmless. These characters are part of a dark, ironic, complex series of events that that don't bode well for any of them. And that's what this film does so masterfully, like you said, is balance all that out.
So thematically, Dave. Well, first, before we get into the theme, to me, Dave, who made this movie great? It's a natural chemistry between Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell. I think that these two actors have worked together enough. They are similar enough that they can carry a conversation. They can carry a dynamic, and it be 100% natural. This is a weird script.
Yeah.
This could have gone off the rails. I know I say this with every movie, but this is an actor driven film, in my opinion. I don't think that there's anything in this script itself that with bad actors would work at all. It would be too scary. Their charisma and their sincere connection to each other, I think, injects enough humor into the darkness to where you are along for the ride the whole time. Whereas it might have, the script itself on its reading would probably be pretty freaking dark, especially when you account for how it ends.
Brendan Gleeson goes to Colin Farrell and he says, "I can't be your friend anymore." Later you find out it's because he's on this sort of search for meaning and he wants to concentrate on making music and having something that will sort of outlive him. Brendan Gleeson or Colin Farrell rightly says, "Well, why does that mean we can't be friends anymore?" And the magic thing about the film is, even though, especially when you get to the part where Brendan Gleeson threatens to start cutting off his fingers and delivering them to Colin Farrell's house if he doesn't leave him alone, you really want these guys to get back together. You really spend the movie wanting there to be an answer to this. And the movie, wow, the movie has an answer for it. All right.
What's the answer?
The answer is that there's some things that can't just that you can't be done with. And in their culture, to be done with something means you're able to shake hands, walk away, and act like it hadn't happened. And there are things that happen between these guys and other characters on the island that make that impossible. And I think often, right now, the island, that I feel trapped on, and I think a lot of people feel trapped on, is the island where you're thinking, there can be answers. There's got to be answers to X, Y, and Z. But there are sometimes you just come to an impasse and you have to part company with people. And there's been more of that going on in the last few years than ever before in this country, probably since the Civil War. And I think that is heartbreaking, but it's also reality. And it's part of realizing that we, how careful we should be of what we say, how careful we should be of what we do. Of the assumptions we make about one another, because it may lead us down roads that we can't find our way back from.
There's a lot of, there's an island in here. And then some of the films this year, people seem to go on an island. They're trapped on an island to get away from others, or they're isolated from others. And these characters are isolated, but they're isolated and they're stuck in a group. It's claustrophobic. They're seeing the same people. They're doing the same things. They're hiding. We talked about this when we actually did the episode. They're hiding behind fences to avoid each other. So they're trapped together. And it's not a reaction to COVID, probably not, but it is in the air. It is in that zeitgeist that we're talking about, where it does feel like we're reliving the same things over and over again. And it's like we're watching the world from our little isolated bubbles. You know, like they watch on the mainland the Civil War unfolding.
This is
great.
This is great, absolutely good.
great changes are happening, but it's like we're watching them from a safe distance, even though we're trapped in like this claustrophobic world. I mean, they're ringing the bell with you here, Dave.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, that sense of, desperation, sets in. And I think that this is a movie that, you know, so often with movies about these quaint Irish towns, right? You know, they're, and I'm thinking of movies like Waking the Divine, right? You know, that are just, you know, very, they're quirky, but they're very cheery. And they're very beautiful. And there's a lot of beautiful landscape in this movie, but there's also a kind of a grayness that hangs over everything. There's a desolation in the midst of all these people being trapped. I mean, the banshee, the titular banshee, right, of this movie, I think, is this old woman who basically predicts when people are going to die on the island. And you kind of don't know what to make of her. I mean, is she a good guy or a bad guy? Or is she just, you know, fate or destiny? I don't know.
That's an unknown. I don't know if there's an answer to that.
It lends a sort of a touch of magic realism to the film.
I do like the air of mystery that she provides. The banshees are described as like harbingers of death, right? And you can re-listen to our episode about how the old woman who has a name and seems to have lived a life could or could not be a banshee. You know, is she actually like a being? But she does seem to be a harbinger of death for, and we supported that case in our longer discussion of this film. You know, one of the other thematic things I think kind of ties into 2022, Dave, was a lot of these movies feature identities that are in flux, and that is beyond 2022. That is a 21st century phenomenon. But in this movie, even though these people are on this claustrophobic island, kind of isolated from everything, watching things through their TVs. Oh, I'm sorry. Watching things happen on the mainland, which is seemingly far away. There is some change on the island. People want something different. Obviously, the biggest person that we come into contact with is Brendan Gleeson's character, who wants a totally different life. He wants a life of different meaning. He's ready to put aside this past friendship and this past way of life to embrace his love of music. Same for Colin Farrell's sister. She wants to go to the mainland and see something new. You know, one of the scenes I love, Dave, and we talked about it when we did our episode of this, is the painting of the mailbox, changing the color of the mailbox from red to green. It's just a little nod to the changing times. That people want something different. And I think the identity is changing. And even though this movie takes place in 1922, 100 years ago, I think it is reflecting our need to explore a reinvention of ourselves.
Yeah.
I think we'll see that in some of our other movies.
It's one of our top three picks. This and the next two movies we go with are, I think, it's fair to say, probably our top three movies of the year. The year, I don't know. Are you still catching up with any movies at this point?
Oh, I'll be catching up for movies for a long time. I haven't seen The Whale. I haven't seen, All Quiet on the Western Front.
I haven't seen that either. I really want to see it.
I haven't seen For Leslie. Oh, I'm not going to see it.
To Leslie.
You're too Leslie. But no, I'm still catching up. Why don't you introduce the next film, Dave? You know, this was one that was at my number one slot for 11 months of the year. Please introduce this wonderful next film.
Oh, goodness. This was a film that I missed in the theater and saw. I think I rented it. Watched it at home, and I have a pretty good setup at home, but I'll tell you what, when I saw it, it leapt to the very top of my heart and my mind. Everything, everywhere, all at once. it is many things, and we're going to talk about those things. But it is a great version of all those things, which I think is pretty rare.
I think it's the most zeitgeisty of our movies. This is a movie that kind of could only be made in the last couple of years. But it's great for so many reasons. We have, it's a mixture of comedy, action, drama. It's weird. The script is bonkers. You know, the Daniels wrote this script, and it's at the same time manages to be so weird with the imagery. When we did our episode, you know what kind of imagery is in this movie. The weirdest imagery from the brains of the most deranged creatures. Yet at the same time, your heart is breaking. You should be laughing. You should be taken out of the moment for some of these images that they're using. But your heart is breaking because you form such a deep connection to these characters. And it's just so heartwarming. But at the same time, does have like an action element, and does have an element of, you know, existentialism, of a philosophical, you know, deliberation. So it's kind of everything everywhere all at once. And it was my number one for some time.
Mm-hmm. One of the greatest things about this movie and the Daniels is, you know, the Daniels' last movie was Swiss Army Man, which was Paul Dano playing a very depressed man who goes to kill himself when the corpse of someone played by Daniel Radcliffe washes up on the shore of this kind of faraway place where he's taken himself to do this very quietly. And he suddenly, you know, goes over to see if he can help because he doesn't know if he's dead or not, and discovers that he is A, very flatulent for a corpse, and B, is able to do superhuman things. And how they accomplish that is beyond. And if you'd have told me that the Daniels were ever going to make a more imaginative or weirder or more heartwarmingly funny movie than that, I would have laughed. You know, Dan Radcliffe traveled all over the world with his dead body double, silicone, you know, version of himself. I mean, it was just the most bizarre thing anyone had certainly ever seen him do. This movie also takes a lot of actors that we've seen in other things and uses them in ways you could never imagine. But also in the filming of it, before we talk about the cast, is in each of the multiverses that they're exploring in this movie, that show up in this movie, they are paying homage to different filmmakers. One of them is Wong Kar-wai, who's made some of the most beautiful kind of romantic dramas ever made. The Wachowskis, they reference the Wachowskis quite a bit in this movie, in the Matrix films. And they get away with all of it. They get away with somehow making all that feel like it's part of one story. Mike, you know, I'm just going to blather on and on about how much I love this movie. What do you want to say?
I think I'm ready to move on to the cast.
Okay. You want to start?
I think for me, Michelle Yeoh is a standout. It takes a lot to lead this film. There's a lot of quick switches, quick cuts, tonal shifts. You know, she's playing a consistent version of herself, but going through different worlds. The character has to explore themselves. And I think she does a great job. And I look forward to talking to her about her when we do our Oscars episode review.
Yeah, she is. She is nominated, as is Ki Hu Kwan and Stephanie Hsu and Jamie Lee Curtis, who are all in this movie. Ki Hu Kwan, you will remember from as a Short Round in the Indiana Jones films. He's also in The Goonies. And then he spent about 20 years doing fight choreography and sort of, you know, feeling like he hasn't been able to get noticed again for a long time. And he absolutely gives an award-worthy performance here. It's a very complex version of a man trying to hold his family together and his marriage together, who also happens to be very childlike and see the best in things. And it's worth noting, you know, he's a fight choreographer, and Michelle Yeoh, of course, is probably the greatest living, you know, female martial arts actor. And they just compliment each other so well in this movie.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis. It's an interesting character she has to play. I think she does a very good job, and it's very humorous to see her in this type of role.
What's her name? What's her name in the movie?
Deidre Bodidra, right?
Deidre Bobidra.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's so magical.
This is a fun movie, and you know, it's so hard to make a movie that really touches into what's going on in a society, as this movie does, perhaps more than all the others, and not be fucking depressing.
Yeah.
Like, and another movie that's going to be, well, we'll talk about our honorable mentions, but there's another film that I think really taps into the zeitgeist really well and is really a great exploration of things going on, but it's a little fucking depressing. But we'll talk about that in our it's not that depressing. It is fun, but, you know, we don't have Triangle of Sadness in our honorable mentions. Triangle of Sadness does get into our, does get into like the punishing of the rich and the, you know, the theme of islands, many of the themes we talked about. And it does explore all these things that are going on in the world, but isn't it fucking depressing?
Yeah.
Isn't it a depressing take? And it's also funny, but this kind of like the Batman, and I guess we're optimists, Dave, look at our picks here, but like the Batman, this movie offers a way out of our current predicaments, and it doesn't just revel in it. Triangle of Sadness, both to its genius and perhaps to its demise, doesn't offer you any ending. But I do recommend that film, but Everything Everywhere All at Once offers a door.
Well, and it offers, as does the Batman. And for a movie that deals with multiverses, I think it offers you a door very carefully that is carefully written around essential questions of identity and family and where individuals belong in the universe.
Yeah, that's one of our themes, identities in flux, Dave. Go on.
And what can give us hope? I mean, I'll tell you one thing that gave me hope in this movie is when I see an actor like Ku Hee Kwan, or, you know, I'm going to talk later about Brendan Fraser and The Whale, and they get a second shot and they just destroy it. They just make it. Or Jamie Lee Curtis saying, okay, I'll be in your movie, but I don't want to wear any sort of shapewear. I'm a 60 something year old woman. That's what I want to look like. That's part of this character. She doesn't play a very likable character until maybe closer to the end of the film. And it's very not what you expect to see her in. And then you got James Hong playing a dad. You know, the guy from Big Trouble in Little China and Blade Runner and the movies like The In-Laws, just, you know, having the time of his life. He's something like 90 years old at this point, and he's great in this movie as the grandfather. And, of course he had to be in this movie. I mean, that's what this movie feels like to me, is like every time you turn around and think something might, oh, you know, what would I add to make this better? You can't add anything to Everything Everywhere All at Once and make it better, because it has Everything Everywhere All at Once already in it. So it's this joyful, hopeful, action-packed, really weird movie that has probably done more to make hot dogs erotic than any other movie on our list.
Some people don't like this movie. A lot of people like it, but it seems like it's a little divisive. It seems like you either love it or just think it's good. I don't know what to make of that. It's not universally beloved as much as I would anticipate. We talked about how it plays into our two themes. I think we talked about this when we did our episode on it, but it plays into I think one of the important aspects of like identities in flux that it takes a piece of is it takes a piece of both immigrant identities in flux and generational identities in flux. So we're all like here in the West. It's not applied to RRR. In RRR, you are handed your identity. But I digress. In the Western films, we're set out to make our own identity, right? And the generational and the immigrant struggle to do that between the generations is very interesting. And I think it is a uniquely American subject matter. Not that other countries don't have immigrants too, but that melting pot of America really melts things well and creates all of these ingenious subcultures like Chinese Americans and how they interact with Chinese people from China, older Chinese people from China, Chinese people from China who have lived here for a long time. So, and I think that that aspect of identities in flux is very interesting, a great snapshot of this period in history in this film, as well as just what Gen Z millennials are going through. I think the daughter really is kind of like an older Gen Z borderline millennial, and how she interacts with the presumptions of the older generations, I think is universal, not just in the immigrant narrative, which is an interesting aspect on it as well, but just in the American context alone. It's there's a lot going on there, and it is very zeitgeisty, Dave, but still a lot of fun. Doesn't hit you over the head with its messaging,
which is amazing considering how emotional it is. A lot of people talk about crying at the end of this film. If you got family issues and generational issues going on in your life, this movie might hit you pretty hard. It's surprisingly insightful and kind of gentle in talking about some very uncomfortable things. And I think we could go on all night talking about different ways it provoked us, different things we loved about it. It's
we could, we got a whole episode on this, don't we?
We do. And I think that, you know, that's really kind of when we get to our Oscars episode, this thing, you know, it's no spoiler alert, it's nominated for 11 Oscars.
It has the most Oscar nominations.
And I think it's fair to say that movies like this can change the way that movies are made. You know, it used to be that the Coen brothers would put a movie out and all anybody wanted to talk about was that they were brothers, right? And now we have a lot of filmmaking teams out there, and we have the Safdie brothers, and now we have the Daniels, and, you know, we have people that are showing what collaboration can look like. And, you know, again, this movie just feels like a giant family making a movie. Just feels so wonderfully collaborative. I really hope that this paves the way for more different kinds of movies to get made than just superhero movies and tentpole type movies.
You like to add like a big hope on the end of things. I don't know what to make of that. Not every movie has to change the industry. Not every movie has to change the industry or save the world, you know, from Jobu Tupaki. Not every movie has to save the world. It can live in its own. It can live on its own.
I want my everything bagel. I don't want to give up my everything bagel.
So let's talk about my number one of the year. And it is a movie that I actually don't think we have mentioned ever on this podcast. As far as I know, Dave, this will be the first utterance of this film, which is my number one. And that's because I didn't see it until late December. I don't know why this is my number one. I don't know why. But when I watch this movie, and I knew that this was a masterpiece, and it has so many of the themes that I love to talk about, and it's so much of its time and place, yet at the same time subverts some of the expectations of narratives that say the same thing, of narratives that are along the same themes, I should say. So we've talked about movies where the guilty and powerful get punished. Yeah. We've talked about Islands, and we've talked about Estrangement. And when we talked about the Batman, we talked about estranged people being villains and being harmful and being abusive. Like the Riddler is estranged. The only community he has is online, right?
Yeah.
So I think Tar is one of the best depictions of a villain that I have ever seen on screen. And I know I'm going to be a little controversial when I call her a villain, Dave. But I think it is one of the best depictions of a villain that I have seen on screen. And it is so of this time. You know, we like to think that, I think if you, a lot in a lot of our narratives, we like to think that the bad guy is going to come from below, like the Riddler does. That they're going to be an outsider who comes in. Like, and I know you love, I know you love horror movies, Dave. What an understatement. You know, in a horror movie, the bad guy comes into the world, right? He comes into the safe world of the protagonists. Tar is a little different. The monster in this story is at the center of the safe world, has all of the awards, is an EGOT, is a lesbian, has a lovely family and a child, is very accomplished. The monster is at the heart of everything that we hold to be in the liberal elite, in the Western liberal elite. They have, this monster has everything the Western liberal elite would hold up to be good and wholesome. Except, as the movie unfolds, we learn she is a monster. And I would say that these are the monsters I fear at night, Dave.
I can't imagine being in a position where that person in this movie, where Kate Blanchett's character had power over me. I think it not only is an incredible portrayal of elitist villainy, but it also portrays the world that she operates in very, very effectively. And there are people in that world who are good people. There are people in that world trying to do worthwhile things, trying to raise families, doing, you know, the things they have to do to advance their own, you know, goals and in doing it in honorable ways. And what's really awful about the Kate Blanchett character is there are so many moments in this film when you feel like if she would have just not, then the movie might have had a different ending. But it's almost like she can't help herself. That's evidenced by the first scene in the movie where she is asked a perfectly fair question by someone in her class and proceeds to take that person apart in front of all of their classmates when there's really no need to do that.
That is not the first scene in the film, though. That's midway through the film.
I thought that was like right near the beginning.
It's at least past the first third. It is at least past the first third.
Wow, I don't know. Okay.
The first scene in the movie is her doing an interview on stage for The Atlantic.
Oh, and that's, yeah.
And the dialogue is so good. Even in that first scene, you start to slowly hate her. They slowly turn, you're like a frog sitting in the water, right? And they slowly turn it up. Like you can tell that she's like a pretentious blowhard in that first scene, but it's not until that scene you're talking about where you realize all the pieces come together and you see that she is a truly hateful person. Fascistic.
Yeah.
She's a fascist. And it's no coincidence that she lives in Berlin and wanted to be in the Berlin orchestra. That's not a coincidence at all. Another, like there are so many subtle nods in this film that she's horrible.
I love that you brought that up because I was watching a clip of Desmond Tutu being interviewed the other day, and it was on a late night talk show. I think it was Craig Ferguson. And, you know, later on, Craig Ferguson talked about how life changing it was to meet him. And as you're watching him, you see someone who is imbued with power, imbued with gifts, imbued with other people's appreciation, but doesn't bask in any of it. And she has become the lizard that thinks it can just lay out in the open and bask. She doesn't even need to hardly hide her wrongdoing until it's too late.
I don't think that she was ever good. You know, I don't know if you're implying that she was good.
No,
I think wasn't. That
she wasn't. In other words, I'm saying she's the polar opposite of someone like a Tutu or another artist. That's a truly admirable person who chooses to use their power to do good in the world instead of provide themselves the opportunity to just bask, you know, in public adulation.
So one of the issues that this movie, and the main issue that this movie takes on head on, is that do the artistic gifts of the person stand apart from that person's flaws? And I think that this film takes a side. We see that Tar is incredibly gifted. She is truly gifted. But her personal flaws destroy her gifts. I think, Dave, you know, this movie goes back and forth and you don't know where it's going to land. But I do think if you take the movie as a whole, it lands on the side that your personal flaws interact with your gifts without, you know, they cannot be separated from each other. I don't know if I'm correct on that. I'd like to rewatch it a couple more times and see if it lands on that side every time for me. But definitely career-wise, she is destroyed by her personal flaws. It just keeps catching up with her. But I don't think she was a con artist. I know that there's a certain reading of the film where she's just a con artist and there is a part. Well, she might be a sociopath, but I think she truly is gifted. But she's definitely a sociopath. She has no empathy or feeling for each other. And I'm not sure if there's any change at the end. I love the ambiguity of not knowing. Like, she's silent at the end.
Right.
This performance by Cate Blanchett, you know, the fact that this is such a horrible person, we see her being discriminatory, sexually abusive, verbally abusive, abuse of power, petty, controlling, aggressive, you know, hateful, yet at the same time, you almost want to sympathize with her. You see her struggling so hard that you almost want to sympathize with her. And I think that this is a masterful performance.
Yeah, well, that's what makes it a masterful performance. And I mean, when I mentioned sociopathy, I agree with you that the character very well may be a sociopath. But it's not as simple as that. I think a lot of the time when we think about sociopaths, they serve the function of just being a villain in usually a genre piece or in a piece of melodrama. This is none of that. This is an incredibly well-made film that follows her down this path of destruction. And even right at the point we meet her, you realize it's too late. Whatever has happened for this person is probably, you know, whatever changed her has changed her into something that, you know, she very well, this may be it for her. And you kind of, like you said, I think you pull for her at different points, but there are other points where you sort of don't eat as well.
I never pulled for her. I almost pulled for her.
That's what I mean. I mean, like, you kind of go a little bit back and forth. You oscillate. And part of that is because of the power of her character.
Yeah, the character is talented and unrelenting. And those are admirable qualities. Unfortunately, some less than admirable qualities overpower them. And the ending is incredibly interesting to me of what to make of the ending. And I like, you know, I love an ambiguous ending. You know, Triangle of Sadness has an ambiguous ending, but it's kind of a cop-out. I'm sorry. You know, it doesn't answer the question for you. I do like that ending as well, but I like that there is an ending here shown, but the interpretation of the meaning is not clear. So I think when I say ambiguous, that's what I mean. It's like, we see how she ends, but we don't know where she ends in her mind, in her, where is she at as a character?
I love the ending of Triangle of Sadness.
I do like that too, but it's a different type of ending.
Yeah. And I don't feel like it's as ambiguous as you do, but I completely agree with you about the ambiguity of the ending of this.
You don't think the ending, I don't see how the ending of Triangle of Sadness could be any less ambiguous. I mean, it literally doesn't have an ending. I mean, it ends on an indecision.
I think it does have an ending. I think you know exactly what's going to happen at the ending of that movie. It just happens off camera.
All right. Well, I'm not so sure. But what
you get that ambiguity.
You see what is actually happening. And you just don't know where she's at as a person. I mean, I have my own ideas. I mean, I think that I know what is going on there, but I would like to see it a couple more times to think what is going on there.
What about the wreckage that she leaves behind? I mean, I think that's a very interesting thing about the world, is it's very centric to her character. And yet, you just think of all the things that she left behind, the people, the institutions that really did benefit from her gifts in a lot of ways. And now they're going to have to move on without her. While they deal with their own sense of betrayal and hurt and everything else.
Well, a lot of the people we see on screen are complicit in her behavior.
There are people like that for sure.
Her assistant, the Berlin Orchestra, her wife, they're all kind of complicit and cover for her or even enable her. So there aren't too many purely innocent people in the film. We get the former student who commits suicide, which kind of sets this whole thing in motion. And I think that's like the touch of innocence in the film, as well as her daughter. But aside from that, you know, it's hard to sympathize with the institutions that enabled her. Because all of the true villains, except for that student she does tear apart, are kind of off screen and unseen. But it's the innocent people that she victimizes that have the last word, you know.
Well, there's the scene you haven't mentioned, and I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it, when she goes back home.
Yes.
That's an amazing sequence that you don't see coming. You've got this immaculate person, this incredibly educated, gifted, brilliant artist, and all of a sudden you find out they come from this, you know, dreary little blue collar town, and that they grew up in this little dumpy little house. And you know, we see her go home and sort of have to make a little retreat for herself while the proverbial hits the fan. And it's at that point you sort of expect to see a huge breakdown sequence or something. And you are denied at that moment of the easy emotional, you know, sentiment. But
2022, we can't make connections with each other. We traveled to islands and we wanted to punish the rich. You definitely saw a very rich and powerful EGOT getting punished in Tar. But it wasn't as cathartic as in, say, Glass Onion or The Menu or where else? What was the other movie where the rich got ate? I don't know. I won't throw Flux Gourmet in there. Triangle of Sadness.
Yeah.
Another one.
Another one.
The Batman fits in there. You know, there's a lot. Well, let's do some honorable mentions, Dave. What do you say?
Okay, sounds good.
You know, I just mentioned a movie that just keeps popping up in my mind. And you know, it's also very zeitgeisty. They go to an island. The rich are getting punished by the working class. I think those are all very 2022 themes. That is The Menu. I love The Menu, and it is in my top 10. There's a great movie. There's a great video on YouTube from the YouTube creator, The Take, that talks about the ending of The Menu and how it's not a cop out. You know, it's great to give like a really definitive ending for a change. That's so rare. The Menu has quite a fireworks of an ending. I think that Ralph Fiennes, oh my gosh, Dave, I love him. I love him. He's
amazing in the film.
I like this movie a lot. There's a lot of class commentary. I recommend it for everyone. Everyone needs to go see this.
Yeah, if Mike hadn't picked this film, I would have for honorable mention. His performance in this film, Ralph Fiennes' performance in this film, he's one of the greatest screen villains for me. He's a favorite, like in my top 10 favorite villains now. It's wonderful.
All right, Dave, what's one of your honorable mentions? Let's do two each.
You know, I'm ashamed to admit that I only got to this film sort of begrudgingly. A, because I was sent a screener, and B, because it just kept getting recommended to me. And then our good friend at Now Playing Network, our wonderful host, Jim Laskowski, said that it might be his favorite film of the year. And I thought, okay, you're a dog if you don't watch this thing. And it's called After Sun. And After Sun tells the story of a young girl's sort of last hurrah visiting her estranged dad. And in most movies of that kind, you set up a simple paradigm where there's some, you know, there's redemption at the end, and there's, you know, like conflicts to work through to get there. This movie is different. We go back and forth from her adulthood to her as a child with her dad. And we see his flaws. We see him struggle with being a dad, not knowing how to do it all that well. We see her in the midst of teenage, and they're out in this big, you know, they've taken sort of this cruise and you know, they've gone to an island or something for a retreat, where tourists play. And so they're having a lot of fun, but they're also, you know, figuring out the things, are not perfect. And one of the things I loved most about the film was how it looks. It's not only edited in a really interesting way, that goes back and forth from the present to the past and back again, but it has a lot of different aesthetics that it delves into to do that are very supportive of the characters and the arcs that the film wants to flow. So an unusual film, but a very good one, and definitely in my category of recommending to people is when I can.
It'll be no surprise that I think one of the tragically overlooked films from this year is The Northman. I think it's all in, you know, yeah. Feet to the wall craziness. I love the weirdness of it. We had a long episode about it. It doesn't really fit into the zeitgeist. I can understand why it's kind of, you know, I think this is what happens when you give nerds money. I think that's what happens with The Northman. I loved it and I recommend it and it's fun, but does it have a lot to say about 2022? No, not really. So for those reasons, I'm not surprised it didn't go anywhere, but tragically underseen.
Well, wait a minute. Now, don't they go to an island?
That's true. They do go to Iceland. I guess that's an island. It's a very big island.
And they punish the rich. They punish the ruler.
I think this is a stretch, Dave.
Oh, I think this is a stretch. And no, I got nothing else.
All right, briefly give us your last honorable mention.
Well, I just want to comment. Mike is not kidding about The Northman. If you like epic action movies, you missed this one, and you missed a great one, and you need to go see it. It's the next
great editing, great special effects.
I mean, it's Robert Eggers, guys. It's the guy who did The Witch and The Lighthouse. And, man, you know, supposedly he's doing a version of Nosferatu now with Willem Dafoe playing Count Orlok. So more power, give the nerd more money. That's what I say. My last movie is a movie that has had some controversy. And I had to think hard about it. It was a bit of a last minute addition because I realized that I was sort of ignoring, I was ignoring an issue that ought to be explored. And that movie is The Whale. Now, The Whale is based, I believe, on a play, which may be based on a novel. It's an award-winning play. It stars Brendan Fraser as a 600-pound, more or less, immobilized man who's eaten himself because of his despair over how his life has turned out, into the state that he's in and away from his family and, away from, being able to, have any kind of relationship. And he's a teacher. He teaches people online, never leaves his house, has food delivered, has this woman that comes and helps to take care of him who has informed him that he is dying. Later you find out things about their relationship. But then his daughter comes to visit him, and his daughter may or may not have his best interests at heart. Is definitely a very conflicted person, and he is definitely wanting to bridge the lost years before he passes away. This is a film by Darren Aronofsky, who, to my mind, has never made a bad movie, and I'm even including Noah in that, which I know a lot of people don't like. He's made some out-and-out masterpieces, like Requiem for a Dream and Mother and Black Swan. But the masterstroke in this film is the casting of Brendan Fraser in the lead. If you have heard that, Brendan Fraser, after the Mummy movies and George of the Jungle, went out and he had a very rough go, he had been physically hurt, he went through a very difficult divorce and lost a lot of money, and we all know that when that happens to people, we usually don't hear from them in the public eye again. But like Hu Ke Kwan, who came back for Everything Everywhere All at Once, Brendan Fraser gives the performance of a lifetime in this film as the lead character. There are moments utter transcendent empathy in this movie for you to experience if you're open to it. I've read some reviews of this movie that I felt were pretty cynical. I've read some reviews of it from people who just for whatever reason didn't emotionally connect with the film. I've read some reviews, and the criticism of the film has centered around the fact that they hired Brendan Fraser to play somebody who weighs 600 pounds and put him in prosthetics, what this was called a fat suit and whatnot. Not only do they do the character justice in terms of how the character looks, not only is Brendan's performance absolutely transcendent, but more importantly, I think there's a larger issue at work here. And that is we criticize everything now. Everything that anybody likes gets taken down a peg in the public sphere, and anything that takes the kind of risks that a movie like The Whale takes has to be, passed through some sort of gauntlet before people will just allow you to enjoy it. And while I absolutely sympathize with people who want to dialogue about the very important issue of things like fat shaming, and body image in this, in the world. I think that it's called acting, guys. It's acting. Brendan Fraser is an actor. B, he's not even a very small man. He's actually been pretty big, physically, since he, lost that beautiful George of the Jungle physique. He's a middle-aged man, and he's still a real big man. And three, this is a performance that wrings every single bit of humanity out of a character that destroyed me by the end of the movie. I urge you to go see this movie. I have a feeling some awards are on its way, one in particular, and you will probably end up having the chance to see it again. But it's not a movie that you should skip because any of the controversy that has surrounded it. Big thumbs
up. All right. I haven't seen it. Just, a skinny man playing a fat man is a no-go for me. That's too insensitive.
What?
Oh, I'm just trying to trigger you.
You are going to get me going. It's called acting. It's like what we're doing right now.
Well, I mean, I think there should be limitations, but that's a discussion for another time. What's our next episode, Dave? We're going to do Oscars and Megan together. We'll do part Oscars, part Megan. I don't know if any Oscars 2024 are heading towards Megan, but we'll at least discuss that film and also talk about kind of our take on the Oscar nominations, which are out now. If you would like to learn more or watch any of these movies, you can pretty much rent. You can watch The Batman on HBO Max. You can watch RRR only on Netflix. And the others can be rented for differing costs at the various, most of them are on YouTube, Apple, Amazon. But The Batman, HBO Max for free, RRR, Netflix. If you want to learn more about us, we are present on the internets. You can find us at mindframesfilm.com. You can also find us at mindframesfilm on the internet. We have the pink logo. If you see a pink logo, that is us. Dave, any brief parting words? Maybe you could tell people to go to our beloved friends over at...
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Look, we're hosted by the Now Playing. We're hosted by the Now Playing Network. We aren't the only thing they host. You should go there. You should check out all of the podcasts on there. Ours is easy to find, like Mike said. It's got the pink logo. And it'll also...
We're not the only thing they host. We are the annex that they host. We're not even the bathroom. We're the annex with the broom propped up in the corner.
We love you, Jim. We don't mean to speak out of turn. It's been a great year in movies. I want to say that I've really enjoyed, and I feel like I still have great movies to catch up on. So the Oscars gives me a chance and an excuse to do that. You may or may not agree with our personal jointly arrived at top five. Let us know what your top five is. Go to our website. Get a hold of us on Facebook. Hire somebody to hire a strippergram and send it to us.
Is that still a thing? I don't think you're as short as I wanted, but thank you for listening.